the history of the Democratic Party in Maine and its lessons for political parties today. The election of Ed Muskie as governor of Maine in 1954 was an upset, a big upset. Muskie was a Democrat and came into office after seven successive Republican governors. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Before Muskie's surprise victory, Maine was known as a Republican stronghold. In many districts, the Democratic Party didn't even field a candidate for the state house. Muskie's victory ushered in a new era in Maine politics and paved the road for other Democratic leaders, including George Mitchell. In a new book, author and journalist Douglas Rooks examines this big change. The book's title, Rise, Decline, and Renewal, The Democratic Party in Maine. And today we'll hear from Doug about the history of the Democratic Party and his insights into what the lessons of a once also ran party can teach politicians and voters today. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In the era after World War II, the Democratic Party in Maine was in disarray. But by 1966, Democrats controlled the governor's office and the state house. What happened to create such a political sea change, and what are the repercussions since then? A new book by Douglas Rooks answers that question. The book's title, Rise, Decline, and Renewal, The Democratic Party in Maine. Doug served as editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and editor and publisher of the Maine Times. His previous book was a biography of Senator George Mitchell. Doug, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Great to be here.
And in the interest of honesty and fairness, this is not a case of nepotism. We have the same last name, but as far as we know, we're not related.
Not very closely.
It's possible, I suppose. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you remember the politics of the mid-20th century? Do you believe political parties need to be stronger today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Doug, I'm wondering how you got the idea for this book. Was it during your research for your former book, The Biography of George Mitchell?
It really was, and it was all about George Mitchell himself. And he seemed a very unlikely candidate when you consider that he was 29 years old when he got his first political job, and he actually said, I'd never thought about politics before that. That's pretty late in the game for somebody to enter politics, and yet he could do it. And what I discovered was the real reason for he had a very supportive Democratic Party and, of course, a great patron, Ed Muskie, as well.
Okay, let's talk about Ed Muskie. And, well, before we talk about Muskie, set the stage for us. By 1950, Maine was a deeply Republican state. How would you characterize the Democratic Party in Maine at that point? Is disarray an accurate word, or is that not even strong enough?
You can debate about the specific word. But the reality was that there were a lot of Democrats in Maine. They were mostly Catholic, Irish, and French mostly, but they were concentrated in the mill towns. And, of course, there were a lot of towns that were mill towns then. Even Augusta was a mill town, as was Biddeford and Saco and Rumford and Lewiston, of course, the largest mill town. And those voters were Democratic by birth. You know, they had immigrated from the other country, and the Democratic Party was their home. So there was a lot of what we would now call block voting in those days, but there was nothing binding these communities together. And when they ran someone, they usually ran an Anglo for governor, and it didn't go very far. There was really no way to tie people together and build the party before 1954.
When you say they usually ran an Anglo, you mean they ran somebody who was not Catholic?
Not Catholic, yes. The French were really discriminated against most intensely in the 1920s, but it was not easy to be a French person in Maine in those days.
Okay. And at that point, I read in your book that many districts in Maine didn't even run a Democrat for the state house.
No.
It was like certain places are today when we read about Texas or Alabama and the Republican Party.
Absolutely. I mean, when Ed Muskie decided to run for governor, he'd already served in the legislature. He was one of 12 Democrats in a 151-member house. There were usually maybe two or three Democratic senators against 30-odd Republicans. It was not a party that was really going anywhere at that point.
So given those odds, how did Muskie do it?
Well, this is the fascinating question. How did he do it? I can tell you that at the beginning of 1954, he wasn't even thinking about running for governor. But he did have a partnership with a very vital person who is not as nearly as famous today. But his name was Frank Coffin. He was later a very distinguished federal judge on the Court of Appeals, First Circuit, for more than 40 years. So people forgot that he started as a politician. And he was the chair of the party while Muskie was the leading edge of the party and their candidate for governor.
And when you say he was the chair of the party, he was the first chair of the party in a very long time, right?
Well, there were other chairs, but he was the first one who conceived of the job this way that we're talking about.
Gotcha.
The previous chair said simply, you know, you can go through the motions or you can do something. And he had a real plan for building the party.
Okay. And so Muskie says, I'll run.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Coffin is his partner in this idea, but they don't think they're going to win, do they?
No. In fact, Muskie still didn't think he was going to run. And it's in the Mitchell book, too, but I've expanded on it. They went all over the state trying to find some of the Democrats from the last era any Democrats had been elected, which was the New Deal 20 years earlier, and none of them would run. And Muskie and Coffin were getting more and more frustrated. And finally, apparently, you know, people saying, well, if you're so up for this, why don't you run? And he finally did. But he didn't even announce until very late in the game after the state convention. And his campaign really took place. And you have to remember, the election was in those days was in September for all state offices. So he campaigned for only about 3 months, and yet he won.
And I learned, this is an aside, but I learned from your book, Doug, that that's where the expression as Maine goes comes from.
It is. And also the famous reversal of that. Most people don't understand that very famous quip that James Farley, who is Franklin Roosevelt's political fixer, said after the 1936 landslide reelection of FDR, only Maine and Vermont, you know, voted Republican in that for the presidential race. And he said, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. And people remember that almost more than the original slogan, but it had nothing to do with being a bellwether. It was simply 2 months before all the other states voted, Maine voted. So you could kind of guess where it might be going, but it was not predictive in any way.
Oh, and that's interesting, too. And that is a demonstration of, again, how Republican Maine was, that only Maine and Vermont went for or
yes.
against FDR in that election.
Those were the most Republican states in the country at the time.
Well, you know, one thing I learned from you, Doug, which I thought was really interesting about Muskie and Coffin's strategy, and boy, is this something that resonates today, is their decision to reach beyond those urban
yes.
enclaves
yes.
that you were talking about, that they said, we're not going to just try to win Waterville, Augusta, Lewiston, Portland. We are going to go out in the country.
Absolutely. They went to places that no Democrat had been seen in 100 years. Muskie had another asset. He had a wonderful Irish campaign manager named Dick McMahon, who was known as Friar Tuck among the campaign team. And he would go as advance Muskie's appearances in these little towns. And Muskie actually had a bullhorn that he would just start talking in the public square and people would come around to listen to him. You have to remember, this is 1954 when there weren't even a lot of cars in rural Maine. But he was quite a sensation as he traveled around the state and people said, wow, who is this guy?
Mm. And you talk about that possibly people even didn't think until then that they could possibly have a choice.
No, they did not. But I should say, because we're on traditional media here, that the press was extremely important. In those days, each candidate for governor got his own reporter. Of course, they were all men, but they'd follow him around and they'd write stories about them every day. I mean, you couldn't ask for anything more, you know, as a candidate than have a good relationship with the press, and they would essentially amplify your message.
So many things were different. I was struck by the candidates asking reporters advice during the campaign.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've been a reporter a long time, Doug. I've never had a political candidate ask my advice while I'm covering that person.
And when I was a reporter myself, I did not hear it either.
That was one of the interesting things I learned from you. Also, how fluid the back and forth between working as a reporter and then going to work for a political campaign and then going back to a newspaper. It happens, but not as commonly, it seems.
It does happen even today, because those are very transferable skills for most people anyway. I mean, good communication skills are rare. So.
So here is the crux of your book. What was the long-term impact of that Muskie victory for Maine?
Well, it wasn't just Muskie, of course. I mean, there were a lot of other wonderful Democrats, very colorful characters. I mean, that's when you have a party with as many different strands, you know, the ethnic strands, the kind of the activist strand. You know, it's a very unruly group, but there's a lot of people who are all thinking like Democrats. And I think we have kind of lost the idea that there's something more to a party than having a set of particular positions that you check off. These were just a wonderful array of people, all of whom had different skills. And, you know, the governors that were elected in this period, of course, Ed Muskie himself, and then Ken Curtis, and then Joe Brennan, which I would say would be the, you know, as the Democratic Party was still in its rising phase, all incredibly different, very different political styles. Very, you know, Muskie was very deliberative. Ken Curtis was very impulsive. Joe Brennan didn't say a lot in public a lot of the times. He made most of his big decisions behind the scenes. They were all different, but they all worked well within the Democratic context. And that's what we're missing now, in my opinion.
Mm. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to talk a little bit more about political parties today in a little bit, but I have to ask you about a few characters. Tell us about Doc Clawson.
Doc Clawson. I barely heard of Doc Clawson. And that's a great example, actually, of how the Democratic Party, you know, even if it didn't have the best talent, it could still shape it. Doc was a chiropractor, actually, but his bigger job was actually head of the Internal Revenue Service office in Maine.
And he Only in Maine.
Well, you know, it used to be a fairly big job, and it was a patronage position as well. So he did that, and that's how he got to know people, through their taxes. You know, Jim Longley later on, a former Democrat who turned independent, was an insurance salesman. These turn out to be very good ways to meet people. Anyway, Doc Clawson apparently was a terrible public speaker. I mean, he really rambled and he was just terrible, but a great retail politician. And the story that's always amused me is when he was actually elected governor, he had a wonderful aide named Maurice Williams, who also served Muskie. And Williams was, I believe, from Newport. Anyway, he went back to his hometown anyway and introduced the new governor. He was really dreading it because the man was boring. He was rambling. And yet, when they went to the Newport meeting place, Doc Clawson insisted on getting there an hour early. And he greeted every single person as they went in. And then he gave this terrible speech, and then he rushed to the exit and greeted every single person on the way out. The next morning, Maurice Williams goes downtown, still not realizing Clawson's attractions, and he was expecting everybody to say what a bore the guy was. Everyone loved him. Everyone loved Doc Clawson because he had that personal relationship with each voter who was in that room.
So why haven't we heard of Doc Clawson?
Well, the reason you haven't is essentially, and this is one of the great ironies of Maine political history, Muskie had engineered a 4-year term before he left for Washington when he was elected to the U.S. Senate. And there was a constitutional amendment, we don't have many of those anymore, that changed it from a 2-year term to a 4-year term. In the 1958 election was the first election for a 4-year term. Doc Clawson won, but he died a year in office. So John Reed, and you have to really go through the archives to figure out what happened. John Reed, who was the Senate president and a Republican, served 1 year as the successor, then won a special election for the last 2 years of the term, and then won a new 4-year term. So that's what happened to Doc Clawson, and the great victory of getting the 4-year term didn't work out for the Democrats.
And also from the same era, Lucia Cormier.
I knew almost nothing about her, and yet she was a great figure who was really the counterpart in the Democratic Party of Margaret Chase Smith. Unfortunately, she didn't win high office in that sense, but she was a very well-educated woman who was the head of the Stevens High English department, I believe, or government department, I'll have to check my notes, in Rumford. And she used that political base to serve in the legislature and the state senate, and she ran against Margaret Chase Smith and was on the cover of Time magazine with her as the first time two women had been nominated for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, the first time two women in U.S. history, two women faced off for the U.S. Senate. I mean, how many Maine school kids learn that? But that's a pretty big deal.
It was a huge deal. And for some reason, that she has been kind of lost in this mist of time. And you never know about why that is, because I think a lot of women today would find her inspiring.
Okay, well, I want to get back to Ken Curtis. I like this. You can explain this now that you've set it up by talking about the Governor Reed. Curtis's campaign slogan was 7, not 11.
Yes, it turned out to be a great slogan. We don't have many great campaign slogans in Maine, but that was a great one. What he was saying was there was now a two-term limit, so no one was going to serve more than 8 years consecutively. But because Reed had not been elected to a full four-year term the first time, it didn't apply to him. So he could have actually served 11 years as governor consecutively, something no one else will probably be able to do short of similar circumstances in the future. And I think that really helped him because Curtis was very young. He was only 35 years old, and his big problem was having people take him seriously as a very young, kind of wet-behind-the-ears politician. And yet, by making people think about the consequences of having a governor in office, because you remember, with the two-year term, no one had ever served more than 4 years before. So it was a really long time to be governor, and I think over the course of the campaign, people thought more about that, and, well, he won, so the slogan worked.
You're right. The scale of Curtis's legislative accomplishments remains staggering. What did Curtis do?
It's hard to know where to start. Pretty much the entire structure of the executive branch today is attributable to Ken Curtis. I mean, state government was expanding. All state governments were expanding at the time. They were all, you know, gearing up to do a lot of things that state governments had never done. That was one of the legacies of the Great Society program. The federal government was encouraging states to do things in housing and environmental protection in a lot of areas that they'd never been active in. But Curtis was one of the governors who took the greatest advantage of that in terms of setting up things like the Department of Environmental Protection, the BEP, you know, just literally hundreds of new state agencies, and then organizing them into a cabinet with commissioners who were responsible to him and thus to the people that way. Before that, it was about 150 separate agencies that, frankly, no one really controlled.
So much to talk to you about, Doug. We have a break coming up, but I'll ask you just really quickly, how did the election of John F. Kennedy affect Maine politics?
That was a very difficult year for Maine Democrats because Frank Coffin, after having previously thought he would run for governor, actually did. And the reason he did is he was coming back to kind of retrieve the party's honor after Doc Clawson died. He ran against John Reed in that special election, and he lost by a big margin. And part of the reason was it was the first November election, so the turnout was much, much higher than it had been for the September election. And apparently a lot of people who weren't too happy about the idea of a Catholic in the White House came out and voted against the Maine Democrats as well.
So despite the Irish and French communities in Maine, there was still a little bit of backlash.
Well, this is a sensitive subject, and I think the most we can say is look at the numbers. You can't get inside people's hearts when they vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be a little wary about drawing those kind of conclusions.
In different times, hard to look back and judge. We're talking with Douglas Rooks. He has just come out with a brand new book about the history of the Democratic Party in Maine, looks at how it went from really almost obscurity in the mid-20th century to a great deal of power. We do have to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
Millions of Obama voters stayed home in the last election, and many of those non-voters were Black.
These people are recognizing that in order to win, you cannot ignore us. And if you do, you will lose.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Why some Black voters won't turn out unless Democrats address issues like criminal justice reform and wealth disparity. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, artificial intelligence, driverless cars, robotics, virtual reality, and other emerging high tech. What are some of the new breakthroughs, like using computers to read scans and identify signs of lung cancer? And what can go wrong? We talk with Cade Metz, who covers high tech for the New York Times, and looks at where these technologies are taking us, for better or worse. Join us.
And you can hear Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Rise of the Democratic Party in Maine. With me in the studio, Doug Rooks. He's the author of the new book, Rise, Decline, and Renewal, The Democratic Party in Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, Doug, I want to ask you, why not write the book on the rise and fall of the Republican Party in Maine?
I would be wonderful if someone did that. I have actually been asked about that. Well, what about the Republican Party? Unfortunately, I'm not the right person to do that, probably, but it should be done. And I think it would be a fascinating story because they'd have a lot longer history, for one thing.
Okay. We'll go to Con, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Con Fulham. I was wondering when I read Doug's book if you were related to somebody who is in that book.
As a matter of fact, I am. I just thought I'd give a shout out to my father, Paul Fulham, who was Ed's running mate in 1954.
He was indeed. I mean, he was a very distinguished candidate.
Yeah, and you mentioned Frank Coffin and Don Nichols and Tom Delahanty, and they were all sort of disciples of my father. So he was an interesting and a great man, and who died way too young.
I think the other thing that's very significant about Paul Fulham and others in the party, John Donovan's another good example, they were college professors. Donovan taught at Bates, and of course your dad taught at Colby, and he had Don Nichol in his classes and all these other people. It's almost unimaginable that a college professor today would be a leading candidate for a major office. And yet, you know, it's not really such a bad idea.
Well, indeed. He was a very reluctant candidate at that, actually.
Was that? Do you think that was primarily, I mean, he was, you know, his doctor originally said, don't do this. And then he decided to do it anyway. Was that the big reason, or were there other reasons for his reluctance?
Actually, well, I don't know the story that actually came about that he decided to run was I was four at the time, and we were outside our farmhouse in Sydney, and a plane flew by, and I pointed up at it and said, "Is that the one that's going to drop the bomb?"
That is in the book as well, and I'm glad to know that it was you. So now I actually have a connection to the person in the story.
Yeah. Well, Con, thanks so much for calling in. Really, really fun. And like Maine, we say about Maine, just one big neighborhood. Thank you, Con. We'll go to Tim calling from Vassalboro. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. In 1954, I was a paper boy in Waterville. And Ed Muskie lived on Silver Mount. And he moved to Augusta after being elected and owed me 45 cents for two weeks. I never did. Being a good Catholic, I forgave him. But anyway, that was my story.
Ed Muskie was a notorious cheapskate. George Mitchell used to talk about that and saying Muskie never picked up a check. I guess it started early.
Oh, Tim, thank you so much for calling in. If you'd like to call in, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I asked you, Doug, how the national election of JFK affected Maine. How about Richard Nixon? Because the time you're talking about, the resurgence of the Democratic Party in Maine, is the same era at which Richard Nixon was elected nationally.
It was, although the arcs of the National Party and the Maine Party are very different. The National Party really burst back onto the national scene more or less permanently in 1932 when FDR was elected. You can see there's about a 20-year time lag. And I don't have any big theory about this, but you can kind of notice that the National Party was kind of breaking up and having more difficulties starting in 1968, really. That was the critical year for the National Party. The Maine Party continued to grow in numbers and voters all the way up through the 70s. So, and then began its decline probably in the mid-80s. So if you believe in historical cycles, there's two that don't exactly overlap.
Though it's interesting, the last era, if you'll say that, is really mixed. I mean, right now our legislature is, the House is Democratic, the Senate is Republican. You know, we have congressional delegation that has both.
Yes. This is what's new here. I mean, the Republican Party was dominant. Then both parties were competing on fairly equal terms. Then the Democrats really had an edge during a period. And now we are back to a situation I'm not sure we've had since before the Civil War, where both parties can make an equally plausible claim to primacy.
Mm. I want to ask you about political parties today and what they can learn from the Democratic Party in the mid-20th century, the party that you're focusing on. What are parties doing or not doing?
I think the biggest single factor in making parties not as effective as they were is the dominance of money at all levels. And we were talking, you know, when George Mitchell ran, or actually when Ed Muskie ran his first race, this is a great figure, all five candidates, Paul Fulham, and there were then three congressional districts. So five candidates running together raised $35,000. That was it. Now, I mean, yes, it would be more today, but not much more. Money was not the impetus behind campaigns. Now you have to raise $500,000, frankly, in a statewide race to even be taken seriously. And not very many people can do that. So you've already limited the number of people who can run. And I think that's true of both parties, but particularly true of the Democratic Party. Parties are not fulfilling the essential function of connecting people at the community level first before anybody decides to run for office.
And in Maine, for a long time, at least a quarter century, there have been more people registered not in a political party than with either political party. You see a problem in that.
I do. And I don't blame the voters. You know, there's always this temptation when the voters don't do what some of us think they should do is say, oh, my God, they're ignorant or they don't really know what they're doing. No. The problem is within the parties. Why aren't the parties attracting more members? We now have four political parties in Maine. We have Libertarian, Green, Republican, and Democrat. It seems like for most voters to get involved, one of those choices should appeal to them. And yet a very, very large number of people remain unenrolled.
So what could Frank Coffin and Ed Muskie teach the leaders of the political parties today?
I think they saw organizing as a community thing. They really did. They would go. It was the same thing when Muskie went to these tiny towns. Well, there weren't very many votes in Castine, but Muskie got a lot of votes in Castine because he went there personally and talked to, in that case, a group of elderly women who had lost their sons to Connecticut, Massachusetts in the brain drain. Sound familiar? We're still going through this in Maine. He got a lot of support in unlikely places. But then they backed it up, and there were suddenly Democratic committees all over the state. I think in the election year, they actually organized 180 municipal committees. We don't have that many now.
Mm. I'm going to go off to Fairfield and Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. How are you? Thank you for taking my call. I have sort of a personal story. My family's been in Maine since the 1700s. But my dad left Maine because of Ed Muskie. Oddly enough, my dad was an attorney in southern Maine, and he was a judge. And at that point in time, judges were appointed by the governor. Well, my dad was Republican. Muskie was not. He was not reappointed, and he was so disappointed that he went into work in Massachusetts. So I grew up partially in Massachusetts, came back as soon as I could when I became a college-age person. But that's my story.
That is a good example of partisan politics. Democrats tend to appoint Democrats to office and Republicans. Although I would add, though, that Maine has, I think, has a good system for nominating judges now. It's not required, but every governor probably for the last 30 or 35 years has had a judicial screening panel, and they make recommendations to the governor about who to appoint. And again, the governor's not bound to that, but I think those screening panels take a little bit of the raw politics out of the appointments of judges.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this already a little bit, Doug. There were judges are still appointed, but mm-hmm. there were a lot more positions were appointed, a lot of patron positions.
Well, the federal government particularly. And one of the reasons, one of the theories behind the sudden swoon of the Republican Party in 1954 is they had patronage for the first time in 20 years. Eisenhower had been elected 2 years earlier, and the Republicans were now fighting over all these patronage jobs. It kind of distracted them. That's one theory anyway. But you have to realize that then I think there might have been 500 or 600 post offices in Maine. Each one was a presidential appointment.
Mm. Marilyn, thanks so much for your call. We'll move on to Skip, who's calling from Stonington. Hi, Skip. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. So when Doug is talking about Ed Muskie going to Castine, it brought back memory. I believe that one of the chairs of the Democratic Party going way back is a fellow named Jimmy Sawyer,
yes.
who became a mentor to me when I ran for the legislature in 72. And you may all recall that in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson was elected president, Maine elected a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, primarily because there was what was called a big box, that you would just check off a big box and it would automatically vote for every office of a particular party. In 72, Ed Muskie was running for president, and the Republicans remembered what happened in 1964, repealed the big box so that you had to vote by office, and some of the young Democrats went up to the University of Maine, where I was a student then, and went through political science and history roles and found students who the Democrats had no candidate in that particular district, and got a whole bunch of us together, and I think there was eight of us that ran, and I think Barry Harbins of Saco and I got elected.
So this is in 1972. You were a college student, and you got recruited to run?
Correct. I was 26 years old.
You know, there were a lot of them in those days. I mean, great names. Some of them are familiar to us now, like John Martin was elected when he was only 23. Jerry Plant from Old Orchard Beach, 21. It was a remarkable time for participation by young people in the political system. And if I may be permitted one more opinion, I really hope that we will be getting more young people running for the legislature.
I agree completely, and I just want to add one more thing. In my opinion, Maine government changed dramatically in 75 when Wiley became governor, and the legislature repealed the executive council. And I can remember Ken Curtis, who was just a wonderful person, having all kinds of, disputes, fights with the seven-person executive council, which was probably made up of Republicans. And there was all kinds of trading going back and forth. There was judges and commissions and whatnot. And one of the other things that came about as a result of the repeal of the executive council was, as Doug was talking about, this panel whereby they would make recommendations to the chief executive about the nomination of judges. And I've watched this for over the years, and I think that whether it's Democrat or Republican administrations, I think Maine has got just a wonderful judiciary.
I would agree with you on that. You covered so much ground that I sort of lost track of what to comment on, but there were a number of interesting points. And Jennifer earlier talked about the 60 election, which was really bad for Democrats. The 1964 landslide election for Lyndon Johnson brought in, it was amazing. There were 29 Republicans and 5 Democrats in the previous legislature. It was exactly the opposite. 29 Democrats were elected. Many of them never expected to win, and suddenly they had to govern. And, you know, the encouraging thing is, even though they were completely new at it, they did some amazing things. The Allegash Wilderness Waterway bond was on the ballot because of that legislature. You know, you can go down the list of some substantive achievements that they made in just 2 years, because, of course, in 1966, they were all swept out again.
Oh, wow. Skip, thank you so much for your call. It's fascinating how quickly things can turn. You know, in whatever political time we're in, we often feel like we're stuck.
I don't think we're stuck. I mean, I think you know, we've had a couple of, quote, wave elections recently. I think we may be due for a couple more.
All right. Well, we'll try to squeeze in one more call before the next break. This is Libby in Blue Hill. Hi, Libby. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very excited about the Democratic Party, and I also am excited about the book. My dad was a ghostwriter for Ed Muskie when he was running for governor. I don't know if you've made any references to him, Spencer Windsor, but he spent a lot of time when I was young lugging me around to all the town halls, listening to candidates and different things. But I'm very excited about the book, and I hope to read it soon.
Thank you.
All right, Libby, thanks so much for your call. We are going to take another break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And before we go to that break, a word about tomorrow's program. With St. Patrick's Day this Saturday, we thought tomorrow would be a perfect time to look at the role of the Irish in Maine. So if you have comments or questions, stories you'd like to share, go ahead and send those in. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the State Theater, presenting Lyle Lovett and his large band on August 1st at Portland's Merrill Auditorium. Tickets available Friday at noon at porttix.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, a comedy about one of the worst dictatorships in history, and I don't mean the producers. It's Armando Iannucci's The Death of Stalin.
It's a comedy of paranoia. It's a comedy of anxiety, really. In The Death of Stalin, if they make a mistake, they're dead.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is Saturday afternoon at 2 and again Sunday evening at 11 on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for World Affairs. On today's show, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich and Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Gray Gipp discuss the Trump budget and what it says about the administration's priorities. That's coming up on World Affairs in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, author Doug Rooks with me to discuss his new book, Rise, Decline, and Renewal, The Democratic Party in Maine. Join our conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I want to read you a line from your preface, Doug, and have you explain this to me. At the end of it, you write, "It is my belief that a well-functioning two-party system is essential not only to democracy, but to the pursuit of happiness envisioned in the Declaration of Independence." Why?
It's a pretty grand statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of course, that's in the book. When you read it aloud, it sounds a little different. But I do believe that. You know, I think the roles of political parties are profoundly misunderstood in contemporary life. You know, we see them as a nuisance, as an aggravation. We particularly hate the other one. But even when we belong to one ourselves, we're not too sure about it. I suspect it's true for everyone. So what is the problem is parties have an essential role, but it's not written down anywhere. It's sort of like the unwritten constitution of England and Britain. Everybody kind of knows what the constitution is, but they can't describe it. It's not written. So, in fact, to give you a good example of why we don't appreciate political parties as much as we probably should, there was a very good scholar. He was he's at one of the New England universities. I forget which one right now. But he said in a recent statement, well, political parties, we could live without them. They're not anywhere written down, not like the Electoral College. Well, my belief is the Electoral College is a real anachronism that is not suitable for our elections today. And yet he thought it was more essential because it's in the Constitution and the parties are not. I would argue that because the parties spontaneously rose up more than 200 years ago, we're talking Thomas Jefferson and in the Republican Democrats of the day and John Adams and the Federalists. And we have not been able to function without those parties ever since, however much we may think we dislike them.
A question from Heidi. Question, there are so many people running, a blue wave of people running to help the party in Maine today. Can the speaker share something that could be helpful about the nuances of the party process, the convention for people interested in running? How can we get involved? So, you write historically, Doug, about neophytes throughout history, people without political experience winning office. What would you say to people who are interested today?
Well, if you had attended your party caucus on the first Sunday in February, you could have been elected to the convention. I believe there are still slots available. So if you were really interested in attending a political convention, which is quite a hoot, it really is. They're wonderful events still, even though they don't get much press coverage. You might still be able to attend. There's a lot of people there. The Democratic convention will be in Lewiston. I should know where the Republican convention is, and I can find out. But they are great events, and they are really, I think, a vital element of political parties.
All right. We'll go to, let's see here. I just pushed a button on my computer, and now I have that little... It's making me wait. Of course it is, Doug. Well, while we're waiting for my computer to catch up with me, let me ask you how you feel about ranked choice voting.
Personally, I have some mixed feelings about it. I do think the first round of ranked choice voting, which will be in the primary elections in June, could be a very, very good thing, because this is a good example of what the supporters of ranked choice voting have been talking about. You know, we'll know probably by the end of the day how many candidates actually made it onto the ballot, but there will be quite a few, particularly for governor. And sorting those out is difficult for the average voter. If you have six or seven or even eight choices, it's going to be hard. So I think there is a place for it there. My concern about ranked choice voting is the primary elections are supposed to present create nominees who then run in the general election. If you have independents who have a separate track in, they kind of go around that whole process. And I am concerned about that. I mean, I know that two main governors have been elected through that route. They were both former Democrats, recent former Democrats, actually. But I'm concerned about the system, because the primary election should be a really big deal. And in recent years, it has not been.
All right. And the Maine Republican Convention is in Augusta, Maine, 4th and 5th at the Augusta Civic Center. We're going to go now to James calling from Rockport. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. Really enjoying the show. So I just kind of observed that we kind of have an interesting dynamic where in the 19th century, we had Governor Blaine, who was very big in national politics, but when he ran for the presidency, stumbled over the issue of the Blaine Amendment, which was perceived as anti-Catholic, and that ran his presidency aground, or his presidential aspirations aground. And then in the 20th century, we have Mr. Muskie, who, because of, you know, what I saw as a scurrilous attack on his character, kind of his presidential campaign kind of stumbled. And I wonder, is there a dynamic there, or what does that say about Maine's place in the national political landscape?
That's a really big question. And the comparison is fascinating because, of course, they are from different eras and politics changes a lot. What I would say about just in general about Muskie's race in particular, which I've studied pretty carefully, is it's very difficult to come from a small state and run for president. You wouldn't think so, but when you look about the successful aspirants in the 19th and 20th centuries, they were usually from places like California. Ohio was the seedbed of presidents for a while. New York State, of course, with FDR and Al Smith both running from that seat. Mario Cuomo, one of my early political heroes, we hoped he was going to run, and he didn't in the end.
So Bill Clinton was an anomaly.
Bill Clinton was an anomaly, and that was a year in which Cuomo was expected to run widely. And the fact that he didn't, I think, didn't help the Democratic Party, because they could have chosen between the old Democratic Party and the new Democratic Party. Instead, there were only new Democrats at that point.
All right. James, thanks for your call. Let's see. We'll go to Jim, who's calling from Stowe. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
I thought it might be interesting. I was elected to the Maine legislature. I was a beneficiary of the stuff that Skip was talking about, the elimination of the big box. But in 1975, Ed Muskie decided that he should hire some young legislators and young people who were involved in politics to help him with his reelection to the U.S. Senate in 76, and I was one of the people that he hired, and he had some great, really some great stories. And one of the things that he told me, he said, you know, young legislators need to remember one thing. You may be doing a great job, but you must always remember not to believe your own press releases. You have to remember who wrote them. Which was a great piece of advice and one I've used a lot over the course of my life. The other thing that I thought was interesting, he told me a story about Lyndon Johnson and when he first got to the United States Senate in 1959, probably. He told me that he had been appointed to the Armed Services Committee and he was a young senator. And Lyndon Johnson came to him and said, I need your vote on this, Senator Muskie. And I can't remember what the issue was. And Senator Muskie said, I don't think I can vote for that. You know, that's not something I believe in. And Senator Johnson said, no, you misunderstand, Senator Muskie. I really need your vote. And Muskie stood firm and then found himself on what was known at the time as the D.C. Committee. And he said, thank goodness that Jack Kennedy picked Lyndon Johnson to be the vice president, or I would have never been reelected to the U.S. Senate because of that appointment.
Interesting.
What's the D, as in the Washington, D.C. committee?
Yes. I can actually tell you what the issue was. The issue was actually a procedural one. It was about the filibuster rule, and Johnson had his version of it, and the liberal reformers, who Muskie was attracted to, had a different version. He wouldn't back Johnson's version, and he got exiled to three very obscure committees. However, there's an interesting ending to the story with Johnson and Muskie. After Muskie went, Muskie became a more prominent senator. Johnson was now president. When Johnson needed someone to rescue the Model Cities Bill, what became the Model Cities Bill, which really helped in the whole renovation and renewal of Portland here. It was one of the first Model Cities grants. He picked Muskie as the guy who needed to lead the legislative charge. So they did have some bad blood between them, but Johnson also recognized Muskie's abilities, and that's what we hope will happen in our political system, that talent will rise to the top and be recognized.
Jim, thanks for calling in. We're going to go now to Tom calling from Portland. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a couple quick things. The first one is that the explosion in 54 of Muskie was primarily due to Franklin Roosevelt being president when all the GIs were overseas and voted Democrat for the first times in their lives. And I think that's substantial. The second thing I want to bring out is that a huge person in the main Democratic Party was Sam Shapiro, who basically financed all the progressive legislation that the top people got passed. And Sam Shapiro was not just the treasurer of Maine, he is a treasurer of Maine. And without him and the fundraising and then the bond raising, Maine would not have the impromptu of the Democrat progress.
Great, Tom. Thank you. You're kind of fading in and out, so I'm going to let Doug respond. Do you want to start by first talking about Sam Shapiro?
I did not know Sam Shapiro as well as I would have liked to. He was apparently a wonderful man and a great storyteller. And yes, I think what he said was right on. You need people like that. Maurice Williams, who I mentioned earlier, who was Muskie's chief of staff, was a brilliant man with a budget. We really need a brilliant couple legislators who really know the budget well today. I feel that's one of the underserved positions in state government. Yes, there are very qualified people in the administration, but the legislature needs its own eyes and ears on the budget. And Sam, you know, from his role as state treasurer, really helped with that.
And how about Tom's point of, you know, when you have the 1950s, you have the GIs coming back from the war.
It definitely created a more progressive voting pattern. It's hard to trace that specifically to Muskie's election. But yeah, there was a very progressive Republican governor in Vermont who essentially established a progressive income tax. Can you imagine that? A Republican doing that. And he was elected right after the war.
Well, speaking of income tax, that's part of what you write about in the book, the creation of Maine's income tax, something that one would believe would be politically impossible. But yet, Curtis was reelected after that.
Barely. It was the issue of the 1970 reelection campaign. And he won by, I think, about 800 votes. History of Maine would be very different had he lost. Because there was a referendum on the income tax, which people tend to merge with the original one, a year later.
Fascinating.
That business groups put on the ballot. It lost. The repeal of the income tax lost by 3-1. It's an amazing result, given how people feel these days about the income tax.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. We have a tweet from Ed. He tweets, "Political parties are what passes for an infrastructure of democracy. Until we evolve one that supports citizen as the highest office in a democracy."
If you read the book, that is my argument as well. I think the Republicans, I mean, we're definitely generalizing here, but the Republicans over the period of the last 150 years have been the party of business. The Democratic Party has been the party of the working person. And I think the Democratic Party really has strayed pretty far from those roots.
An email from Rodney. "My dad, Rodney Quinn, was a confirmed Democrat and was elected Secretary of State for Maine in 1968 by a Republican House. He served until 1978. Unfortunately, while he was in politics, I was out about in the world and didn't pay much attention to what was happening in Maine. My understanding from what others have told me that served with him is that he was the reason Maine was blue for so long."
George Mitchell said this very well. If you don't want to take all the credit yourself, You know, it's amazing what you can do. But I think the true story of the Maine Democratic Party is, you know, we haven't mentioned, and not all the names are in the book, but Roddy Quinn was certainly part of it. Ed Peart, a wonderful Democrat from Bath, who was the House clerk for many years, was also part of it. There are just a lot of different people who really contributed. And, you know, a political party's success is never about one person.
Jeannie says, why don't we fight for open primaries? More people are independents than party affiliated, and we indies are locked out of the most important election in my mind.
Well, there is an answer to that that's different than ranked choice voting, and I can't get into it in detail, but it's described in Chapter 8, I believe, about Vermont. Vermont has a system that I would call fusion politics, where you can run the same candidate, or you used to be able to, on the different lines. So you could have a Green Party candidate who is actually also the Democratic Party candidate, or a Republican candidate also be a Libertarian. You add up all their votes, and that's who gets elected. And that's actually how the first Democratic governor of Vermont in 100 years was elected, with those, quote, third-party votes. So that's an alternative I think we should consider, because I really do believe that people should, most people anyway, belong to a political party, and I think they would if they felt it would make a difference.
Okay, Doug, I want to end with the column or the op-ed that you have published today in the Kennebec Journal. And what you really have done is look at the student protests going on in Maine and around the country and tied it into a history lesson from your research for this book.
You know, it becomes kind of, you spend so much time in the past that you see a lot of the times how it's related to the present. I hope that stuff is useful. I think if I were a student today, I would be interested. I hope so anyway, because, you know, I knew when I was growing up, I thought I knew about a lot of politics, but I missed an awful lot, too.
Well, your lesson is that, I don't want to tell you, put your words into your words. Tell us what you think the politicians need to, how they need to be looking at these students.
Well, I think ultimately they need to listen. It's the same as any human relationship. People who have hardened their hearts or their minds against change are really the biggest problem we have. You know, we all have to engage, you know, with the other side. I mean, you've heard this a lot on the media, but it's a serious, it's not easy to do, to listen to people who you don't really disagree with. And parties were always that way. You'd have a lot of people within your own political party that you really just couldn't stand, but they had a certain goal in common with you. And that's how parties work when they work. So I guess the lesson for politicians is, you know, stop talking so much and listen.
Douglas Rooks is the author of a brand new book, Rise, Decline, and Renewal, The Democratic Party in Maine. He has also been editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal in Augusta, editor and publisher of Maine Times. And his last book was a biography, Statesman, George Mitchell and the Art of the Possible. Roddy Nickbor ran the board today. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Again, tomorrow we're going to discuss the Irish in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.